Welcome back to the Wildside News. And now, Sydney Wildsmith.
One of the things we've learned is that environmentalists over the years have, contrary to the spinmeisters and media masters, been right way ahead of others, and they paid a price. For years, they've talked about limited resources, destruction of habitats, the depletion of our oceans, and of course, global warming. And they were right when they said it, and we are paying the consequences for not listening then, now. So when we hear the scientists saying that amphibians may become extinct, it's time to listen to the voices of the Earth when we return here on the Wildside News. Scientists are finding that amphibians around the world are being hit hard. Many species are just gone. Many are struggling to hold on. And because they are the low-lying creatures of bogs, swamps, and ponds, and hidden in the floor of the deep woods, people just don't think about them much. But there has never been a more chilling announcement than that the entire class of amphibians is threatened. We now turn our attention to what is being done around the world to address this potentially catastrophic frog march to extinction. Our conversation about the crisis in the amphibian world continues now as we travel out to Washington, D.C. Joining us now from the nation's capital is Robin Moore, who works with Conservation International. He's a conservation biologist. His specialization is in amphibians. He's, as a matter of fact, part of a group that is forming called the Amphibian Specialist Group. Robin, welcome to the Wildside News.
Thank you.
First of all, for people who aren't familiar with Conservation International, tell us just a little bit about their mission and what they're doing these days.
Well, we're a non-profit working to conserve ecosystems and species globally. We work in a number of priority regions called hotspots and wilderness areas. We target areas based on vulnerability to threats and also irreplaceability, so places that have endemic species that occur nowhere else. And we work on a number of projects, and mainly in developing countries which don't have the resources or the funding to do the work that we do.
Right, very much like the Nature Conservancy, which does create the funding to go in and just buy up land where it's needed to protect the diversity and other factors. You work sort of in a similar way. You are prepared to take action directly.
Yes, yeah, a very similar way. We work in a variety of ways. One way is by buying land, protecting areas. Another way is building capacity in areas to do conservation work. We believe very much in working with local people, local communities, and involving them. The idea of conservation without people it doesn't work, and you need to involve local people if you're going to be successful.
Well, Conservation International is taking a real serious look and doing quite a bit of work now in what is becoming a major story within those people who follow such stories, and that is that the future of amphibians is suddenly becoming very questionable. Why don't you give us a background on what is being discussed in the levels of your expertise about the future of amphibians?
Yes, it's a very serious issue. It was first noticed in 1989. It came to the attention of experts who convened and started sharing stories on amphibian declines. And it became apparent that there was a global phenomenon of amphibians declining around the world. Since this time, it's become more and more apparent that we're experiencing a crisis of unprecedented proportions. In all areas of the world, in Latin America, in Asia, Africa, Australia, Europe, we've been seeing dramatic declines in the population of amphibians. And one of the scary things, or the things that raise the alarm bell amongst conservationists, is that many of these declines are happening in otherwise protected areas, in places where we wouldn't expect to see declines. And almost one-third of amphibian species are threatened with extinction, which is a huge proportion and far greater than any other class of vertebrates. So there is indeed something very real and very large going on that we still don't know a lot about where the declines are happening, what's causing the declines, but we're gradually increasing our knowledge and have identified a number of threats which seems to have caused some of these more enigmatic declines.
The fact that a class of animals is being affected so dramatically is what I think is a really frightening scenario. It's as if, I mean, if someone announced that 30% of all mammal species were threatened, people would really pay attention. Somehow the amphibians kind of, they're hidden away. You know, people don't pay as much attention. They're hard to notice in many cases. And so, unfortunately, but when you talk about a class, this is what I'm concerned about as a biologist and a naturalist. There is something unique to this particular class of animals that makes it extremely vulnerable to changes. Talk a little bit about what it is about the class of amphibians that puts them at such risk, and particularly in these unusual situations, as you say, where they're disappearing where otherwise they should be protected.
Yeah, well, as you said, if it was mammals or birds, I think people would be a lot more alarmed. People get alarmed when they hear about one species of mammal, let's say a tiger, at risk of extinction. But this is an entire class. And it's interesting because amphibians have survived fairly unchanged for over 30 million years. So in some ways, we'd expect them to be very resilient. But they're also very susceptible to environmental change. They have certain characteristics which makes them vulnerable. They have a permeable skin, so they're in direct contact with the environment. They can absorb pollutants. And they also live on the interface of the land and water. So they're influenced by changes in water quality or changes to the to their terrestrial habitat, which makes them also very vulnerable to any changes in the environment. And I think these qualities set them apart. They also have eggs which lack a shell, so they have another stage of their development which is susceptible to changes in the environment.
Is there anyone that stands out as perhaps the most susceptible characteristic that's causing some of these dramatic changes?
I think there have been certain characteristics which have been associated with declines, and these are species that live at high altitudes and stream breeding species. And it would appear that these species, or these groups of species, are most susceptible to a fungal disease that has been spreading throughout populations and causing a devastation, particularly in Central America. And it could be that these conditions in these localities are ideal for the disease.
Is this chytridiomycosis? Am I saying that correctly?
Yes, okay. That's correct.
Yeah. What apparently is being revealed is the fact that chytridiomycosis is, as you say, spreading, but it seems to be on a global basis, that it's reaching into areas that you wouldn't assume. You know, one has to wonder, how is it spreading? Do you know at this point what the basis of that dispersion is?
It's been suggested that it originated in Africa. The first known record came from a species in Africa.
And what time frame is that?
That was in the early 90s, I think 1938.
Okay.
The mechanism by which it's spreading is unclear, although they have managed to actually trace or track the spread of the disease in Central America to show that it spreads at around 28 kilometers a year. Hmm. And they've been quite consistent in being able to predict its spread, which has also allowed us an opportunity that we don't usually have in that we know where it's going to hit next, that we know which populations are going to be affected. And this gives us an opportunity and a responsibility to act, to try and prevent these population crashes that we know are going to happen if we don't do something. So in terms of how it's spread, we don't know. We don't know its level of persistence in the environment once it's spread through. And we don't know why it affects some species more than it affects others, and some individuals more than it affects others. So there's still very, very much that we don't know. Our knowledge is really in its infancy, because this disease has really taken hold faster than we've been able to do the research to understand it. But it certainly, it has been proven that it spreads through these populations, and that populations that are clear of the disease are being suddenly affected, and this is coinciding with population crashes.
So if chytridiomycosis appears, let's say, in a pond area, a certain area, we'll say a region, a localized region, what's the prognosis? What happens? How long does it take before you begin to see changes? And then also, and I realize it varies, but generally speaking, is it sort of generic across the spectrum of amphibians, or give us a little sense of what people are finding out?
It basically is a very rapid response, which is another of the problems. It can happen overnight. You can find hundreds of dead frogs, basically. So if it hits a pond, you may suddenly find just piles of dead frogs, which really makes it hard to respond, because once it's hit, it's too late. There are a few species that are known to be carriers of the disease without actually being affected by it, without dying from it, and we're not sure why they're able to carry the disease. But these could also be important vectors in spreading the disease. So we really need to get a better understanding of what makes some species more vulnerable. But there have been instances where entire communities have collapsed because of the disease.
Now, is this extant on all continents at this point?
It has been found in all continents. It's caused particularly severe die-offs in Central America and also in Australia. But it's been located in Europe, it's been located in Africa, in Asia, and in North America also.
So is it safe to say that perhaps this is your first line of hard-edged research and really trying to deal with this because it is the most identifiable single threat?
Currently, there's a lot of research being directed towards it, yes. I think what's important is not to lose sight of the fact that there are other threats. Habitat loss is still actually the primary threat.
Right.
So we need to be sure that we don't ignore that, and we also focus on preserving the habitats that they live in. And also important is to consider interactions between threats, and it may be that this disease is having such a big impact because it's interacting with, say, climate change or with habitat loss or with other stressors, which could be making the amphibians more susceptible to the disease, or pollution may reduce their immunity. So I think it's very important that we, while we really focus efforts on getting a better understanding of the disease, that we don't neglect the other areas of research and the other conservation priorities.
Right. It is going to take an approach that embraces all of them. Of course, the habitat destruction is something that you can kind of see and stop as needed. But this other this fungus is a silent killer. It's hard. It's going to be difficult to really know where and how it attacks. So let's talk now about, therefore, in terms of this overall plan, what is being organized globally to deal with this threat. Because some people are saying, You know, the headlines are that amphibians could literally pretty much disappear off the face of the earth. I don't know what the time frame is. I don't think anyone's really trying to project what that is, but that's scary. So it does require now a global response. And talk about how researchers like yourself and others are coming together to try to really pool their knowledge and also their efforts.
Okay, yeah. I mean, it really requires a response at an unprecedented scale. The current conservation practices aren't stemming the decline, so we need to really come up with something new and innovative to try and prevent these extinctions. We are in the process of developing an amphibian specialist group under the auspices of the World Conservation Union, basically with the goal of implementing a global unified strategy to amphibian conservation. And the idea will be to coordinate research, to implement long-term conservation measures, and to continue assessing the status of amphibians. And we're in the process of developing an action plan, which has an estimated budget of around $400 million, which we anticipate it will require to implement this plan. And it's comprised of habitat protection, a number of the traditional conservation practices, but we're also trying to develop new and innovative measures, including collecting amphibians in the wild and establishing captive assurance colonies, trying to breed them with the intention of ultimately being able to reintroduce them back into their natural habitat. This is something we can do when we know that the population is going to crash, when it's in the wave of the disease, and we know that we're going to lose these individuals if we don't do something. And it's a way of buying time, basically, to allow us to catch up in our knowledge of what's causing these declines, what role the disease is playing, how we may be able to control the disease. Because currently we can actually control the disease in captive conditions. We're able to collect individuals and treat them for the disease. But currently there's no known way of treating the disease in the wild. So therefore we have to adapt and try to come up with these new ideas. So there's a large movement now towards establishing captive assurance colonies, and we're trying to build capacity in the countries where these declines are occurring to be able to do this. So in Central America, we're trying to establish facilities to be able to breed amphibians. And it's important to realize that this captive breeding is going to be linked with other conservation measures such as habitat protection and trying to establish ways of managing populations in the wild and managing the disease, so that the ultimate aim will be to conserve the populations in the wild and not just to have captive colonies.
It sounds to a large extent like a field biologist's dream come true.
Yeah.
Traveling around looking for and finding and capturing significant enough numbers to start a breeding arc. The concept of kind of an arc for amphibians is really what we're looking at. Some animals are very, very difficult to breed in captivity. What's the status on amphibians? Are they considered sort of okay or difficult or what?
For some species or groups of species, we have good experience and knowledge of how to breed them in captivity. For many species, we know very little about their natural history and about how to breed them. So it's going to be also a steep learning curve. They do lend themselves to captive breeding. A number of species are able to be bred in captivity. There is an example of a successful program with the Majorcan midwife toad in Spain, which involved captive breeding and reintroduction.
Mm-hmm.
And it resulted in the species being downlisted from critically endangered to vulnerable as a result of this successful reintroduction back into the wild. So this program provides some optimism that this strategy can work, and help recover populations in the wild. And we may lose some species in captivity, but if the alternative is for them to become extinct in the wild, at least we tried. I think it's a case of weighing up the risks against the benefits. We may have success with some species, we may not have success with others, and I think it will be a learning process also. We will learn which species we're able to breed, which species are more difficult. But there is a fairly good body of knowledge at the moment. A number of institutions have had success at breeding amphibians, and they take up relatively little room. They can be bred. So in terms of groups of species, I'd say they were fairly suitable for captive breeding programs such as this.
You know, as a biologist, I recall that when I first heard about cloning, it actually came from research on frogs who were able to regenerate legs and arms and things like that, and that was a very unique characteristic of some of these creatures. Are cryogenic preservation and possible future cloning being considered, I imagine?
Those are ideas which have been suggested. Those are potential avenues we could go down. They're not being put into place at the moment, but it's a possibility, definitely.
Now, when you come into because you're working internationally, I'm trying to imagine what it must be like for you to get the attention of for a government so that they will participate with you. How's that going?
It's always a challenge to bring policymakers, governments on board. Luckily, we have a history of working in a lot of these countries where we're working, Colombia, Peru, Panama. So we're able to work with them. A lot of the problems come when you try to move animals out of the country for, say, captive breeding. And our intention is to not have to do that, is to be able to breed them in the country. And they're a lot more receptive when you're trying to do things in the country. It's hard sometimes getting the permits that are necessary. A lot of the legislation that's in place for preventing the movement of animals is quite antiquated and sort of hampers attempts such as this. So we come across quite a few hurdles, but hopefully we're overcoming them, and generally we're able to work quite well. As it varies from place to place, obviously there's a lot of politics involved, but we're trying to bring people on board, and it's working.
How do you increase public awareness and concern about this? What can people do now, not only in the United States but as well in countries around the world? What kind of help do you need?
At the moment, the main thing that's the main help we need is financial resources are lacking, and obviously any awareness that we can raise, public awareness, it really helps. It's hard. People often come and ask what they can do, and it's often hard to really give advice as to how they can help, other than make a donation to help with the efforts. Say in America, there's programs where you can volunteer to help with surveys or to help on conservation projects.
Are you familiar with organizations that people may be able to contact where they could find out more about that, for example?
I'd suggest that people could contact myself, or there's ARMI, the Amphibian Research and Monitoring Initiative, which is run by the USGS, which may be able to advise people on how they may be able to become involved with that.
Mm-hmm. And in terms of helping to contribute and support the work that's ongoing, what's the best way for them to do that as well?
If people are interested in supporting the work, again, I'd say to contact myself, and I can advise and work with them to do that.
Well, tell them exactly how they can do that.
Okay. My email address is probably the best way to get hold of me, is rdmoore@conservation.org.
Let's talk about this a little bit. Why do amphibians matter? This is you've given probably most of all of your life. Somehow you became involved with amphibians, but why do they matter?
Well, one of the biggest challenges is convincing people why amphibians do matter. They're a very important component of the ecosystem. They feed on invertebrates, which in many cases are crop pests or mosquitoes. And without amphibians, many of these invertebrates would boom. And the consequences for ecosystems of losing amphibians, we don't fully understand, but we know that it would be fairly devastating. In some areas, amphibians make up most of the biomass, the vertebrate biomass, and therefore are very important. They also hold a lot of medicinal properties. From a purely anthropogenic point of view, they have been used throughout history for their properties. There's a peptide in the skin of some species that can be used to combat HIV. And if we lose species before we've had the chance to determine whether there's something valuable in the skin, then we're never going to know. So we're losing potential medicinal benefits by losing these species. So I would say it's a very important that we hold on to amphibians, not only for their intrinsic value, but also their ecosystem services, and also because of their value to people.
I know from my perspective, because I cross between science and art, I do not believe, well, let's put it this way, they provide what I would call, I'm making this term up, but like spiritual jewels to our world. They are some of the most beautiful and elegant and amazing and exciting animals, many of them. In terms of their colors, they're outside of fish, for example, there are no other animals and that compare. And if we were to lose these from the earth, we would lose so much. This would become a much sadder place, a much more mundane world. We sure don't need that.
I couldn't agree more. Some may call me biased, but...
I think we need that type of bias. I'm biased in the same direction. Robin Moore with Conservation International, I want to thank you so much for lending your voice here on the Wild Side News.
No problem. Thank you.
At times, we can feel helpless and even hopeless about the decline of our living systems. But we can also let this be a call to action. Perhaps we have been given a long enough ride on the road to luxury, so that now we are rested and fattened and wise. And so now there is no better time to lift ourselves up from the fog and folly of complacency and to suit up with waiters, field guides, and gentle hands to help the majestic gifts that have serenaded our souls from the beginnings of time. Now, up, take action, spread the word, before the wonder lies shattered and torn. When we return, another call to action by the son of a man whose life was taken, calling us to action. Robert Kennedy Jr. speaks of nature, people, and the powerful when your voice of the earth continues here on the Wild Side News.
I'm getting a catcher's mitt.
I'm getting ice skates.
I'm getting a jigsaw puzzle.
I'm getting dying coral reefs.
A blue bicycle.
A walkie-talkie.
I'm getting a severe drought.
Cool block skateboard.
I'm getting melted ice caps.
A killer heat wave.
A shrinking glacier.
I'm getting a devastating flood.
Adults are generous. We're even giving kids global warming. But it's not too late. We can still reduce greenhouse gas pollution. Go to fightglobalwarming.com. Brought to you by Environmental Defense, the Robertson Foundation, and the Ad Council.